David says, "To dissemble anger may require the willingness to surrender pride that underlies that anger, which in turn depends on surrendering a desire. This means surrendering the fear that energized the desire, which again is related to the undoing of imaginary loss, and so forth." Here he expands upon this statement to illuminate insights about anger and what you can do to work with it in a way that will illuminate your spiritual path.
All negative feelings are linked with each other. You want something because you feel unfulfilled. So if something gets in the way, now you get angry. Now you get frustrated, and you realize that if you get it, now you're going to be prideful. But if you're prideful in your ownership, now you have to fear that somebody will take it away from you or that you won't get it. And then you envy other people that do have it, and you get puffed up if you do have it. So one thing leads to another. So your anger is that somebody is interfering. And they're all based on the same delusion, and the delusion is that the source of happiness is something outside of yourself. When I get that title, when I get that car, when I get that job, when I get that income, when I get that, there's always a get. When I get that relationship, when I get that recognition, when I get on the TV program, when I get on the nightly news, I'll be somebody, you see? It's always a gettingness. So if anything stands in your way, that gettingness, now you hate it and you're angry at it and you want to destroy it. So when you see that one thing leads to another, then if you don't achieve it, you feel guilt, self-blame, you feel worthless. Now you feel depressed. All the negative feelings are based on the assumption that what you need is outside of yourself. You see yourself as incomplete. And once I'm famous, once I'm educated, once I'm older, or once I'm richer, no matter what you say, once I have that title, then I'll be happy. It always puts fulfillment off in the future. So you're always coming from incomplete to incomplete because you're incomplete, but then when you get what you want, there's always one better. I knew many super rich people back east. I was with them in certain kinds of relationships, and they always had a saying, no matter how big your yacht is, a bigger one will dock next to you. And I saw that with some of the great famous yachts. A friend of mine was a designer of the World Cup winning yacht, and other friends of mine who owned world famous yachts. And sure enough, they say, you know, if we tie up there, you watch. And sure enough, you tie up there, and some Maharaja from Pupa would load up in a 400-foot yacht with 8 decks and 32 servants. And so no matter how rich you are, so there's always somebody richer, you know. So it's an endless race, and it was very comical to see it. And, of course, people who are really quite wealthy and have been for some time live very simple lives for public events, parties or something. But I knew lots of multimillionaires. And very often they would inherit a big estate, you know, 40 acres with a huge castle of a house and all these buildings and all. And when you go to visit them, they actually lived in one of the servants' houses. There's a little house out there. That's where they lived. It's one of the richest people in America. I used to live next door to one. He had a third story on his house, you know. And I said, "What's up there?" He says, "I don't know. I've never been up there." And rich people, they would usually put two or three rooms in this big giant house, the family estate, you know. And there'd be a kitchen and a sitting room and a bedroom. And that's where they lived all their time, 99% of the time. Except when their great niece was here and having a birthday party, and then they would have a party on the lawn. But they lived all their time in just a little corner of the house. What are you going to do on the third floor with 5,000 feet of magnificent furniture and you? You and 5,000 feet of antique, beautiful furniture with a wonderful view. And once you've looked out the window and seen the view, now what are you going to do? So you go back downstairs to the kitchen and watch the TV, put your feet up and put some wood in the stove the same as the servants do. It's comical. Our country is a meritocracy. A meritocracy. People like to belittle it and curse it for one thing or another. Frankly, it's a meritocracy. In other words, one gains to the degree that one pursues excellent, self-sacrificingly, all the so-called virtues. If you follow all the virtues, you'll find it is a meritocracy. If you're always on time, if you do your job well, you'll get paid well, you'll be respected. So a meritocracy then spurs people to performance, to high performance and effort. And there's nothing wrong with the meritocracy. The degree to which you align with it then depends on your own personal ambition and your own innate energy level. Some people have enormous amounts of energy, were born with it. Other people just don't have that much energy. So a meritocracy tends to reward the fastest rabbit. And naturally, run, rabbit, run is what you're going to do. The faster the rabbit, the more lettuce you get. There's no point in making that wrong, by the way. There's no point in getting a moralistic one-upmanship and say, oh, and isn't that awful? Nobody asks you to say, and isn't that awful? That's projecting your own value system onto the world. But surrender to God's will. That God's will be done, and then we surrender our willfulness and accept what is with grace. The fact that the mind can imagine something else doesn't mean that that's a reality. It just means the child in us wishes it had a bigger, longer car, see? But that's only the child. So you learn to discount that which is not of any great value to you. I think the realization comes about through spiritual awareness. We know that greed and lust are one of the seven deadly sins, etc. I think it's only when you come to the realization. So the reason for the talks we have here is it's the first time they've heard such a thing. Well, I never heard that the source of unhappiness was the way I see the world. I always thought it was, well, if you don't have much money, of course you're miserable. So they never realized that it stems from within. Well, once you realize that you are the source of it, now you become empowered. Well, if I'm the source of it, then I can discontinue it, of course. All you have to do is discipline yourself to let go of wanting a certain thing. And you can do that by seeing through the illusion of it. And you see the illusion of it. It's true that certain things will fill a practical purpose, but that is different than happiness itself. Happiness is feeling satisfied. Happiness is having your favorite kitty sit on your lap and purr. That's happiness. And you don't need a new Cadillac in the driveway to do that. When my kitty sits on my lap and purrs up a storm, there isn't anything more I want in the universe. What more could there be? What else is there? A happy kitty sitting happily on your lap. So what more is there? Or a happy dog next to you with his tail wagging. And I always point out, you know, the calibration of a cat's purr is 500, low love. And a dog's wagging tail is 500. So there's something mysterious about pets, cats and dogs, that we don't know. And I don't know what the answer is yet. There's some karmic significance there. We feel fulfilled. So the dog, it's not unconditional, because he won't be that way with everybody. With you, he's unconditional. You can clip him, beat him, and he'll still wag his tail when you see him.